This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman. This is London FinTech Podcast, episode 80. Brought to you in association with Smart Pension, Synchron, and Archover. I'm delighted to be joined today by Jason Dupree, CEO of Privitar, a data privacy firm, to discuss data privacy. I guess it's a topic we're all familiar with in one way, shape, or form, but what's the word from the inside? What does it mean to design privacy as opposed to add it on the top, like hundreds and thousands sprinkled on a trifle? In our increasingly totalitarian state, the word privacy is an interesting one in itself, as privacy is increasingly being legislated against rather than guaranteed. In an interesting announcement in an otherwise very dull election campaign in the UK, the Liberal Party announced that if they get into power, they will repeal the UK's draconian spying laws where everyone is subject to all of their private data being read by a zillion government agencies. I recall seeing the list, and something like the Parks Agency was even on it. Now, for far-off listeners, this is an easy statement for them to make, as the Liberals are currently polling in roughly single figures and have never won an election in the UK. However, what caught my attention was their analogy, that the laws, and the plans to expand them yet further, in old money amount to hiring a private detective for every person in the country who follows them around and knows everything they say and do, just in case that person commits a crime in the next year. Crazy, and also very hard to understand what privacy means in that context. So, privacy goes all the way from the philosophical, what is privacy, through the political, and how come MPs exempt themselves and the state, especially the deep state, exempts itself completely from scrutiny? And it goes all the way down to the far more practical level of IT engineering. It's also the topic of the GDPR, a blanket EU regulation of huge import. Whose data is it and what does privacy mean? Privitar are an example of RegTech that Mark Beeston described in LFP 077 as enterprise tech that has broader applicability outside FS. And he should know, as Illuminate Financial are an equity investor in Privitar. Privitar's clients range across many sectors, including pharmaceuticals, retail, and telecoms, as well as FS. So maybe for once, we have here a guest who gets outside the citadel of FS. I wonder if it's a world of colour and sunlight out there. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Jason. Thanks for joining me today.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me. It's great to be on the show.
Now, Jason, you're rather like many people. After 80 podcasts, I'm getting to put people into archetypes or stereotypes, and you're typical of a small, highly productive, but perhaps quite crazy subset of guests and fintechers, in that you're one of these people who's doing everything at the same time. So you've got a business which is growing, which is incredibly demanding thing on its own. You're busy having more and more babies, and you try and fit in things like triathlons. So I'm always very jealous of people who get anything done, let alone those who get lots done, because I get next to nothing done myself, and I can never find time for things. So how on earth do you make time in your life to do all these many and diverse things? Or is it just coffee?
There is a lot of coffee. I think the reality is that I'm probably not getting the time to do the triathlons at the moment. Starting a new business, especially 2 years into the project, is incredibly demanding. I suppose no one really plans these things, and it just so happens that you end up in a position where you're starting a company, growing the family, doing major renovations to the house, and you know, all of these projects are converging on 1 month in one particular year. But I suppose the more you do, the more you manage to fit in somehow.
Yes, that's true, actually. I mean, people always say that you never know what you're capable of until it's necessary to do it. They say this in all sorts of circumstances, whether it's sort of walking across the Antarctica because your plane crashed, you know, or coping with all these things in life at the same time. And it's kind of become a bit of a rite of passage at the moment, which is that, and there are, I think, structural reasons for it, which is that you get quite a lot of startups and tech companies founded by people in their early 20s, which is great. But in the world of FS, which is heavily regulated and all that, by and large, the ones that seem to be succeeding more to me are those where people have got 10 years experience or so working and or in startups or in FS and all that kind of thing. And then, of course, by definition, at that age, there's a good chance they're married. And by definition, there's a good chance they're married to someone roughly the same age. And therefore, there's a good chance that they'll be having a sort of family at the same time and And then it's a question of fitting everything in. And the world does change in that I recall when I joined the city some time ago, it looked really good being a 50-something because you got paid loads of money. You didn't do anything. You just wandered around, had a few lunches and basically told someone what to do every now and then. And of course, it's gone completely wrong because I'm actually having to work for a living rather than just swanning around and having lunch, although I do fit in the lunches as well. So going on to the career journey, I mentioned experience. So how did you get from schoolboy in shorts to where you are today?
So you might have gathered that I am South African, but have lived in the United Kingdom now for just under 20 years, practically a lifetime. Essentially, I finished up at university in South Africa, the University of Cape Town, and before graduation day even, got on a plane and jetted down to Sydney, but decided that, you know, I wasn't quite ready for the sunny weather and the beaches and the relaxed lifestyle that offered.
Well, another decade or two over here, you will definitely be ready for them.
Indeed, and felt that I had to get closer to the action, as it were, so came to London with the intention of staying for a few years before heading back south. And couldn't have been more wrong, so ended up working for two software companies for 2 years and then deciding that I stood a better chance of doing something interesting on my own, and started my first business 2 years after landing, a software company called M35, which we grew together with my partner over a period of about 7 years before selling to Thomson Reuters.
And it's interesting because, I mean, going back to the election, one of the political footballs we've been talking about for some time is immigration and, you know, la la la, let's not go into that, but just empirical observation is that first generation immigrants, which is, for example, my former mother-in-law was a first-generation immigrant. She came from Czechoslovakia when it was very communist and there was a very thick iron wall. Somehow, the right kind of first-generation immigrants are incredibly successful and more successful than the average person who started here. And there must be something about the mentality, which is, you know, you land somewhere and you've got to make it a success or something, as opposed to, you know, you've been here from a baby and all you have remember has been in the UK and that kind of stuff. And maybe it's a bit like what I was saying about this comment that we never know what we're capable of until we're actually doing it and go, oh, we are. So is there some sense if you come to, you say you were very fortunate in avoiding Australia, of course, you would want to end up there, ha ha. You avoided Australia, you came to the UK. Was there a sense that somehow you might have to make this work? Or was there a sense, because you're an individual who's changed companies, that you can make things happen as opposed to just fitting in at, I don't know, Slaughter and May or something like that?
No, I think that's true. And, you know, you arrive in a new country with very little, you know, network, very little in terms of resources, and you have no choice but to make it work. That said, London is also, back then and you know, remains so, a fantastic place for innovation. You know, a great melting pot, very diverse set of cultures and opinions, very well connected to the world. So it was a great place to think about starting a new business, and you know, couldn't have chosen better, really, in that respect.
Yes, it's always useful to be reminded that it is a land of opportunity. Again, you read the same sort of kind of free newspapers, no doubt, as I do, and there's always so much moaning going on about the UK and all that. But it's good to remind ourselves that people come here and there is a lot that can be done by able individuals. So you created a business, you created a startup before, and you obviously enjoyed it so much, or you're so crazy, that you thought, I'll do it again. How did that work out? Did you wake up one morning and think, oh, data privacy, I'm going to set up a data privacy firm?
Indeed. And, you know, I guess I've always been passionate about technology, and, you know, moving into Thomson Reuters had a great exposure to the information world and the value of data. And, you know, these things have come together in really interesting ways over the last 5 years. Data represents an enormous amount of power, and as data has been collected and generated by technology companies, there's an imbalance of power that's been created between the companies holding data and data subjects. And that was just a very intriguing problem, partly inspired by my business partner, John Taysom, who had spent some time at Harvard a few years before, where he wrote an essay highlighting some of these concerns. So Thomson Reuters brought us all together, and rather serendipitously, I suppose, in the summer of 14, the real question was, is there a business opportunity here, and can we help organizations do better in this area, in this space?
Okay, so let's dive into data privacy. So starting with philosophical, what is data and what is privacy? in this context, and I mention that because although it sounds crone of quotes obvious, I'm sure the devil's in the detail in just taking data. I think if I was given sort of 1 second to define what data is to save the planet, I'd probably sort of say, you know, bits flow between computers or something like that in this context. But then while you're talking, I was thinking about this recent global worm that's affected computers and all that, and clearly a different type of data is the data that Microsoft had about a vulnerability and yada, yada, yada. So data can actually mean many things in many contexts, and we're always reading tech articles on big data and, you know, yada, yada, yada. And I've never actually seen one where people reflect on, hang on, so what is data? Now, obviously, it's something, having created this business, you've spent some time thinking about, and no doubt you have some sort of kind of definition of.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, taking a step back and thinking about privacy, defining privacy, well, we could spend half the morning having that conversation, and I don't think we have time to do that. So for the moment, let's think of privacy as the state of being unobserved. And data in this context, you know, we can start by saying, well, what isn't it? And I think it's important to recognize that it's not crumbs, it's not footprints. People talk about a data exhaust. It's not that either.
So a data exhaust, meaning not many people I speak to talk about data exhaust. I don't mix in the right circles.
The outputs from a process, it makes it sound ephemeral. It makes it sound semi-permanent. The reality is that the data we generate and collect, the digital life that we're leading today, is a permanent fixture, right? As individuals, we strive towards cashless transactions where every transaction we make is recorded forever. We use social networks where our social interactions and the way we think is profiled. We use apps that are geolocation aware so that our position of every moment of every day is recorded forever. And so this is really what we mean by data. It is big data, and big data is essentially data about people.
So in this context, it's kind of stuff about people, really. So going back to the Investigative Powers Act, or whatever it's called in the UK, one of the things there is that, you know, whoever it is needs to hand over your browsing history, because that's some sort of data, what have you been browsing, and all that kind of stuff. One thing that springs to my mind in this context of hearing the word data is I quite like to hierarchy. Funnily enough, I heard it from a Burmese monk many, many years ago, which is the hierarchy of four, which is that you've got data at the bottom. Once you've got enough data, you've got some information. Once you've got enough information, you get knowledge. And then the top of it all, which certainly doesn't really apply to IT at this stage, is wisdom. So you've got data, information, knowledge, and wisdom. So, you know, on that basis, again, there's many ways of defining it. On that basis, data is literally just the sort of, you know, the hardware, the bits or something like that. The information is actually what those zeros and ones mean in terms of your browsing history. The knowledge is, hey, Mike goes to these really strange places and, you know, hangs out with some odd people, da-da-da-da-da. And then the wisdom is somehow coming from a completely different place to put all that into context.
And I think what's changed significantly, you know, in terms of the way we think about this problem is that we now actually have data. This has really changed largely due to the proliferation of new sensors, the most obvious candidate being your mobile phone. And so we've had plenty of theory around how this data can be used in complex algorithms. We talk about machine learning, we talk about AI. But these theories have not really come to fruition. They haven't been proved until very recently. And really what's precipitated that is the availability of data. We're now collecting and generating more data than we ever have before, and that's bringing these theories to life. Cost of compute have come down, the algorithms have improved a little, but this combination of data and the algorithms is really turning things, you know, upside down in that respect. And so we're going directly from data to insight, often in ways that are very difficult to understand.
Yes, absolutely, where sort of insight is perhaps sort of knowledge or wisdom in the hierarchy I was talking about.
Correct.
I quite like the idea of privacy being the state of being unobserved, which gets harder and harder, as I say, but for those non-English speakers, there is a word or a euphemism or an idiom for toilet over here, or for closet, water closet, bathroom, of privy. And certainly when you go to the privy, you want to be unobserved when you're going about your ablutions. And so, you know, if we start with something as sort of crude as that, it's quite clear what privacy means. We'll get on a bit later to a much more sophisticated understanding when it comes to the GDPR and EU regulation.
And another way to think of that is, you know, do you ever value those moments where you just mull a thought over in your mind, in your own head? Or open that conversation with a few trusted friends or your partner at home? You may start with a specific viewpoint, but end up with a completely different conclusion. And In those contexts where there's that degree of intimacy, you need to know that you're not being observed. I think observation in that context can actually alter the outcome or direct your behavior.
Absolutely. It's been shown many, many times that the spying that goes on, or you know, the kind of superstarsy level of spying that goes on, has and does inhibit conversations. I mean, I know some people from all along the spectrum, from people who are sort of relatively radical in their thinking to people who are sort of utterly conservative. And actually, if you just speak to the people who actually try and think out the box, a shocking number, actually, if I ever get into a conversation about this, say, oh, actually, they censor themselves online. They don't tweet or Facebook about what they think about stuff, you know. And before you know it, public discourse or something is closed down. And then before you know it, the private discourse on things doesn't happen, especially because of political correctness and all that kind of stuff. Oh, you're not allowed to think that, and blah, blah, blah. And we're then getting into a state, going back to mention my ex-mother-in-law from Czechoslovakia back in the old day, you know, then what it's really like when you can't actually trust people to have the private conversation. We were talking before we started, as I always do, and privacy there means that there's an implicit assumption that you meet a human being and you chat about stuff, and they keep that private. So it's actually a fundamental part of how human beings interact. So getting away from sort of philosophy and what it's like to be sort of great apes with frontal cortexes and all that kind of stuff, maybe just sort of leaping before we have to go into the regulation stuff, which is very important. But I like the thing when looking at a website about data engineering or whatever you call it, and you're talking about privacy and security, and I was mentioning one of the early hardware computers to be built with security built into it was a machine called CAP at Cambridge University in the early 80s, which I particularly remember because those are the last days of sort of real men doing computing, and they had some switches on the front panel, like, you know, up-down switches, and actually you could toggle in various bytes into the computer, which is far better than all this sort of drag-and-droppy window stuff if you want to be hardcore and crazy. Ultimately, I think that wasn't necessarily successful because it had a very kind of linear, hierarchical model of security. So maybe we just touch on, is security the same as privacy, or does privacy imply you need security in your computers? And then talk a little bit, perhaps, about what you mean by data engineering, and what I was saying up front about trying to design systems with that at the heart of it, rather than sort of chucking it on top later and just adding some passwords, as it were.
So I think security is a very useful analog to privacy. Certainly the field of security is far more mature and well-developed than privacy. So in security, we know what good looks like. There are a variety of standards that we can adhere to. And while it's still a rapidly developing field, it's, you know, far ahead of where privacy is today. I think a useful simplification is to think of security as protecting data from unauthorized access, while privacy focuses on what information can be derived from that data once it has been accessed or with authorized access. And privacy engineering deploys tools like anonymization, differential privacy, query restrictions, to move beyond this binary approach to data provisioning.
Just stopping to explain some of those phrases for people who aren't experts in the area. Can we just take the sort of phrases and briefly just explain what they mean?
So I think within this context or field of privacy engineering, we have a number of different techniques. They're all concerned with the central thesis, which is that essentially within a given data set, there is certain aspects of it that contain economic value, and there are other aspects in that data which are harmful or can provide, you know, identifying factors that we want to be able to isolate from the economic value. So the high-level thesis is that we can disambiguate these two things and we can reveal the information that is valuable within a specific context while at the same time protecting or shielding the harmful distinguishing factors in data.
So, for example, anonymization, which everyone will get, is that, I don't know, let's say I've got a website or whatever, for the sake of argument, this is not going to work, but it's metaphorical. And I can see the numbers of people that downloaded this episode and not that. But I can't tell whether you downloaded this episode or that.
Yes, so I think if we're looking at these techniques that allow us to reveal valuable information while masking the identifiable or distinguishing factors and protecting privacy, then we look at a variety of methods of doing that. And because not all data comes in the same shape or size, because we don't access all data in the same way, we need a variety of techniques to protect data in each context. So at the very highest level, anonymization means producing a version of data in which it is impossible or very difficult to identify an individual in that data set.
So metaphorically speaking, it's like an Excel spreadsheet with a whole bunch of data. One of the columns is the names of people, and you know that's irreversibly deleted, and then that's being anonymized then.
Yeah, and where this becomes more complicated is that, you know, what we know is that you have identifying attributes in a data set, like a name or a national insurance number or an IP address, but there's plenty of other data that can also be used to identify an individual, and so this becomes much more difficult to manage. If you take geolocation data, which is becoming prolific, how many apps on your phone collect your geolocation data and store them somewhere centrally? You know, telcos make heavy use of this type of information as well. Examining geolocation data and your location vectors within that data, where you live, where you work, where you go to gym in the evenings, that vector is incredibly identifying and very difficult to remove from the data.
I mentioned primates before, and moving on to rodents, human beings are, as I understand, much more like rats than they are like mice, because rats tend to run along the same path 90-odd percent of the time. If you've got a rat in the kitchen, going back to UB40 song, they will use the same path over and over again, whereas mice sort of scurry randomly kind of stuff. And what I'm hearing you talking about here is two things, one of which is that directly identifying material, Mike Ballerman, is the first kind of thing. But the second is actually there is indirect stuff which looks anonymized, but because of, amongst other things, human behavior and the technology that is around, from this the identity can be derived. And of course, going back to all this money that's spent on spying and all that kind of stuff, and they're the biggest users of big data, and I'm sure they're the biggest consumers of data engineers and all that kind of stuff. Like most things, the state of the art is to be able to re-derive knowledge, like the knowledge of the person, from more and more kind of anonymized data. I presume it doesn't suddenly shut off. Let's say we've got an Excel spreadsheet with 256 columns, and I delete the name column. Oh, I think it's gone. But then you come back and say, oh, Mike, well, actually, here, there's a geolocation history column. And from that, actually, you can work it out. Oh, shit, I better take the one out, so that one goes as well. But I presume that there's no stage where you get to 100% of the privacy removed on complex data sets, because someone clever enough can use something which you wouldn't even think of.
Correct. And that's why we have to look to other techniques. And I think the important thing to note there as well is it's not just about identifying you. From the same data, we can derive things about you. So we can begin to profile the individual. From that same geolocation data, we can identify your social networks. We can identify your sexual orientation. We can identify the size of your family. So once we start to layer in this level of profiling, that's when people start to become uncomfortable because of the huge insight that can be derived from that data and, you know, the observations that we can draw from this information in a way that the average citizen doesn't quite realize.
And going back to privacy from whom, I mean, using my privy analogy of the loo, where by and large most people lock the door and don't want to be observed by anybody as they're going about their businesses. When you were talking, I was thinking about Facebook, who were just fined this morning by the French data authority for something around the privacy thing. And I was thinking of that as an example where privacy isn't as absolute as the idea about not being observed, because actually people can have differential levels of privacy. I'm glad to say I'm not a Facebooker, but as I understand, there's some stuff you share on Facebook which quotes your friends, your connections to use a better term. Your connections can see, but people to whom you're not connected can't. So how does, going back to the privacy engineering, how does that kind of perspective on privacy work, which is that there are different classes of people who I'm happy to see different levels of information?
I think this is, you know, key to the whole philosophy of privacy by design, which says that we should only expose as little information as is required in every phase of the data lifecycle as is needed for that particular phase. So it's about having those controls in place. It's about being able to have a controlled release of information as is required in each phase of the lifecycle. We're not talking about absolute privacy here. That's also important in the commercial context. We want to have trusted relationships with certain entities, perhaps our bank or our mobile operator, because by sharing certain information with those organizations, we get a better service, we get a better product. So we want to be in control of what is shared, we want to understand the implications of that sharing process, and we want to know and trust that organization to take due care with that data. But we're not looking for you know, a solid boundary. We're not looking to restrict that sharing completely.
Yes. So that probably leads quite nicely, given that I hope we've sort of shown that data privacy isn't as simple as it sounds, and there's, you know, implications with implications, into the GDPR, this EU regulation that's coming up. I mean, I went to a sort of breakfast seminar which recently at Fox Williams, which barely touched on the topic, but did give sort of a fairly wide angle on what was happening and why it was happening. And I think by and large, what they were saying was that a lot of it is actually very sensible. It expands on the data protection we had already. There were some interesting ideas about extraterritoriality and that kind of stuff. And maybe from your perspective, this is wonderful because it's one of these things which stimulates organisations to actually have to do something by a certain date, and therefore they need to take action. Moving on from the philosophical stuff, in a way, it doesn't really matter what the sort of philosophy is, or how you define data, or how you define privacy, because this regulation is going to appear, which we will have to comply with, and even post-Brexit, I understand, if we want to do business in Europe and that kind of stuff. So, in black and white, there are definitions of this, and what organisations across all the sectors you work with have to do. So, we could do a whole series of podcasts on GDPR if I remained awake. We don't have time for that. Many people listening will be deeply familiar with it because they're up to the neck in it themselves. For those who aren't, what do you think the key elements of the GDPR that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Sure. I think the focus typically is on the headlines, so the scale of the fines that can be levied against firms for contravening the Act.
And the scale of the fines are?
Well, 2-4% of global revenue of the ultimate parent company. So
that's
talking
quite a lot.
About a huge step up. And you mentioned the France Data Protection Authority issuing that fine of €150,000 to Facebook. In the same week, the Italian data protection authorities have levied a €3 million fine to WhatsApp for a similar contravention. And I think this is a strong warning signal to firms that these authorities are stepping up, they're issuing these enforcement actions, and come May next year, the order of magnitude of those fines escalates very, very significantly.
So, yes, exactly. So, I mean, as I recall reading about the French one and Facebook, £150,000 was the maximum that they could, for this particular instance, fine, which obviously isn't going to dent Facebook's profits too much. However, fast forward to the future, if Facebook or WhatsApp or whoever contravene something, they will absolutely notice 2-4% of revenues, which is one reason that it's sort of, you know, a lawyer's wet dream here, because people actually have to do it. And if they don't do it, there's a massive consequences.
And the spirit of the Act is that it's meant to be dissuasive. It's meant to be commiserate with the harm. And so, you know, I think that will definitely satisfy those requirements. But I think taking a step back, you know, those are the headlines. And I think people are broadly familiar with those challenges. The spirit of the GDPR, often not explored in much detail, it's obviously there to put in place protection of the citizen, but it's also designed to create a safe place for data innovation. So it's trying to instill a cultural shift, and, you know, it is regulatory imperialism in that it's pushing this regulation out into the world, you know, as many as 9,000 US firms affected.
So there is an extraterritoriality element to it.
Enormous, right? Any company operating in Europe will need to comply with the regulation. But really what it's saying is, know your data, understand what you have, understand how it's being used, so transparency over processing, be in control of that data, be able to remove data if required, and be able to manage very carefully the consent for use of that data from your customers. And the whole point of that is to engender trust in that system. If you have a trust relationship with your end customer, they are likely to contribute higher quality data, and they're likely to consent to the use of that data in that ecosystem, which, you know, has a positive sum game across the piece.
And having said we've disposed with philosophy, it does actually occur to me that one bit that comes back is that, as far as I understand, one of the central elements of the thinking behind this is that people own their own data, which is a thing that sort of knocks on to open API banking and sharing information in open banking going forwards. So the attitude has changed, the mentality has changed from for the sake of argument, Facebook or Amazon. And I mention these not as companies who get it wrong. These are companies who spend a lot of effort trying to get it right and trying to comply with regulation around the world and give you a good service and yada, yada, yada. But historically, I might have seen, for example, I don't know, my browsing history on Amazon, something that Amazon's got is Amazon's because, you know, they're collecting it. Whereas the mentality of this, as I understand, is actually, no, it's not Amazon's, it's mine, because it's my browsing history with a capital My.
Well, you'll certainly have greater control over what these companies can do with your data. And I think as an individual, you do have a responsibility to decide who you trust and respect to use that information. And you'll be in much better control of it with the new regulations because consent will have to be far more explicit. That said, typically we express as individuals, this is a human condition, we express concerns about data privacy. But often behavior is different. So I don't think that it's, you know, right to leave it to individuals to make those decisions entirely. We tend to discount the potential harm of doing anything very dramatically if that potential consequence is a long time in the future, this hyperbolic discount function. And so, you know, we do need to take responsibility for that. But at the same time, organizations who are entrusted with that information need to really take responsibility for looking after and caring for that information in a way that, as I said, you know, builds trust in the system and ensures the continued flow of high-quality information into the system.
Yes, I mean, people are certainly quite schizophrenic about data privacy, data protection. And I don't know, I know I am. Sometimes I get exercised by this sort of state looking at everything in this totalitarian way. But other times I read articles which sort of go on about, oh, your data and all this kind of stuff, and ads are being targeted at you. I don't give a monkey's. I mean, if I'm going to look at some web page and there's an ad on it, what do I care whether it's being targeted or not? Actually, I do care, because where it's targeted, it's generally done fairly badly, and it's something on Amazon I bought 6 months ago. And I keep being shown it all the time. So actually, that's more of an irritant and more showing that people have done it badly. But I suspect there are very few people who most of the time have a sort of a balanced view of data protection. They either get sort of hysterical about it or don't give a damn.
We are seeing sort of exponential adoption of ad blockers, preventing those ads from appearing in your web browser, and that's having a fairly significant effect in the publishing industry, where a lot of those revenues are disappearing. So, you know, it's not without consequence. And recent research by the World Economic Forum has predicted that, you know, today 5% roughly of consumers make decisions based on data privacy policies and their perception of an organization's data privacy stance. But that will grow to as much as 25% over the next few years. So this is definitely a growing concern amongst the population.
It's interesting, and just to sort of wrap up this bit and ask you more about Privitar directly, the other thing that occurs to me that I've been reading quite a lot about recently, I mean, it's a known topic, but it takes some time to really sort of sink in, which is the internet bubble that we live in. Originally, the internet was just a static web page and we'd all see the same thing. A good example is Expedia, which I use a hell of a lot. But Expedia certainly pays attention if you spent sort of a couple of weeks searching for somewhere, because you certainly notice the last-minute prices. But it's not just that, but it's been seen in the political domain as well. So to the extent that what we're seeing from the internet is almost individually created information these days, that can have a hell of an impact, you know, all the way from politically down to, you know, which printer you buy from the computer. So moving on from the GDPR, before we wrap up on Privitar, I'd just like to thank all the listeners out there. Hope your data's private. And thank my brand partners for the podcast. Archover, secured B2P business lending, connecting businesses requiring finance with investors seeking a secure and favourable return of up to 9% per annum. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrolment.co.uk. Synchron, digital business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS. From startup to 7,000 people, 18 countries, and $400 million of revenue. So, Jason, as we said before, you know, we could talk for hours and hours and hours and hours about this topic, so we can just aim to shine a little light on various areas. We haven't spoken much about Privitar. Maybe just before on the Privitar, one thing that occurred to me, which is that I didn't know whether you know what the GDPR says about how well you share information. So if their fundamental philosophy is that it's my data on Amazon and it's my data on Facebook and it's my data is my current account, and the GDPR imposes an obligation upon, well, in this case, websites, we just say, keep it simple, to share my data. The one thing that is not clear is how well and how easily they have to share it. So, for example, Tom Blumfield from Monzo has made the point that although going forward in open API banking or whatever it is, whether in the UK or Europe, banks will be required to share the data. How well they do that in terms of designing an API, which is useful, is a separate matter. So is there a sort of quality of how well the information is shared?
So I think, Mike, that's a very broad topic. Specifically within the context of PSD2, I think it's a slightly different focus. And there is a degree of controversy over how banks will respond to that requirement and how effectively they'll make high-quality information available to the challengers, to the fintechs, and still stay within the compliance of the regulation.
Excellent. Well, that'll keep me in podcast for some time to come, as that will take sort of several years as a narrative to spin out. So going on to Privitar, you mentioned that you've been at a startup and now in many sectors. So where are you at the moment? And where are you going? And which of the thousands and thousands of listeners really should be checking you guys out as having some potential commercial relevance to them?
So Privitar is based in London. We're growing rapidly. We've built a great cross-disciplinary team really at the intersection of this problem of data, cybersecurity, regulation. And we're helping organizations across all industry verticals really make data more broadly available within their organization, particularly sensitive data, enabling sharing and collaboration with innovation partners, so actually being able to drive and expose sensitive data outside the boundaries of the organization. And importantly, build insight over existing sensitive operational data stores and creating a huge amount of value there. So really removing the obstacles and barriers to innovation, ensuring regulatory compliance and bringing risk down across the data estate.
One thing we haven't touched on so far is, are you doing this via products or via services? Are you sort of selling products or are you doing kind of consulting at the extremes, or is there some mixture?
So privacy engineering is a deeply technical field and is a nascent field. I think we can draw some parallels to machine learning and AI. Much of the seminal academic work has occurred over the last decade, but we're really only seeing commercialization of these techniques over the last few years. And Privitar is essentially taking cutting-edge intellectual property in this space, and we're embedding that into software products which we're licensing to our customers. So we're making these techniques available to our customers through licensing of software products in much the same way as you would use TensorFlow or Google Cloud to build data applications. You can use our Privitar Publisher and Lens products to build privacy engineering into those data pipelines.
And then, again, this is a sort of whole topic in itself. How do people in practice, especially in FS perhaps, in huge organizations with thousands of computer systems connected with sort of a combination of sort of lead pipes and string and sellotape over years, you know, how on earth do you take an organization like that and kind of make privacy central, or do you just sort of operate in one business unit in one area rather than trying to re-engineer, for the sake of argument, Citigroup's global privacy architecture?
I don't think there's a simple answer. You know, perhaps there's a clue in the new regulation coming in, which really says take a risk-based approach. So what we typically advise our customers to do, and we work with them closely to do this, is to catalog the relevant data sets and what we call a data situation, which is where that data is being used and by whom, and then rank those situations by risk and deal with the highest risk areas first, you know, and bake these techniques into those processes.
Okay, that's interesting. So having started talking about sort of philosophy and politics, I can see that actually by the time we get to the cutting edge, the coalface, another metaphor mixing phrases, what, as you say, we're seeing here is a confluence of two things. We're seeing a confluence of very recent academic, as it were, IT research over the last decade and very recent regulatory change in Europe in a sphere which has grown far faster and far more rapidly and changed far more rapidly than the law. So especially bearing in mind this 2-4% thing, I don't like using scare tactics, but it does put it into context. All organisations at one level or another are really going to have to get their head around how they comply with this regulation, as you say, even firms based outside Europe. And in terms of how they comply with all this regulation and in terms of how they leverage it to turn it into a positive rather than just a must-do, then I can see that, by definition, the most modern techniques are very relevant, and firms like yours, who are deeply embedded, and I think there is a lot of strength in having multi-silo approaches in terms of different sectors, can help them going forward. So for anybody who's sitting there on their privy worrying about privacy, maybe they should check you out, Jason, and thank you very much for that insight. I wish you every success in the future.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. Like the mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight.